Now on BBC Radio 4, film director Alex Cox is here with a new series of portraits of some of cinema's greatest filmmakers. In the director's chair this week, Stanley Kubrick.
I don't think that he was a very communicative human being. I think that was in his persona, his character. I'm sure that he was a bit repressed in some way.
He was a total control freak. He wanted to know everything, every detail.
He liked pressure and he pressurized others. I mean, he was not easy. He was a complicated man, hard to please. I liked it. Not everybody did.
Stanley Kubrick, compared to most directors, had a free ride. He made what I think are some of the greatest films ever. 2001, A Space Odyssey, Dr. Strangelove, and Lolita. But even when he made a film that wasn't so good, the press were generally afraid to criticize the work. Instead, they picked up on personal eccentricities, of which he had several. He was mythologized as a power-crazy and eccentric recluse who was frightened of the world unless he was controlling it. But his widow, Christiane, knew someone very different.
I thought that he was the most intelligent man I had ever met. He was ambitious and loved films, and in that sense was really more pure than most showbiz people.
Kubrick was the son of a Viennese doctor who was brought up in New York's Bronx. He started out as a photographer on Look magazine. Following some Hollywood success with the film Spartacus, on which he replaced the director Anthony Mann, Kubrick came to England in the 60s to make Lolita. He ended up staying here. He set up home with his family in a Victorian manor house in Hertfordshire and was, along with Spielberg, one of the only directors studio executives had to go and see, rather than the other way around. Perhaps because of this, the biggest myth that dogged him throughout his life was that he was a recluse.
At Stanley's funeral in March, there were over 120 people, and I don't think that Howard Hughes managed to muster as many people when he died.
Film critic Alexander Walker enjoyed a 40-year relationship with Kubrick, stretching back to when Kubrick was a young filmmaker in his native New York. Walker says Kubrick wasn't a recluse in the accepted sense of the word.
He was a person who felt that it was easier to get on with his work if he did his work in secluded circumstances. That's to say, if he only saw the people that he needed to see. Quite a few of Stanley's acquaintances, which later ripened into friendships, if he liked you, began from a need to know.
One of the people he needed to know at one time was science fiction writer Brian Aldiss. Kubrick had read a story of Aldiss's called Super Toys and tried for several years to develop it into a film called Artificial Intelligence.
He did live as though he were a hermit, but in fact he wasn't a hermit. He was in touch with all kinds of people. One reason why he got up late was because half the night he was patrolling his vast technology-filled rooms, waiting for California to come online, for the guys there to get up so that he could talk to his friends.
There was a joke that I think Steven Spielberg made that before the internet, Stanley was the internet.
Brian Aldiss felt there was more than a passing resemblance to the Argentinian revolutionary Che Guevara.
He wore jungle green, he'd got a lot of curly hair and a beard, and he got a beret rammed onto this hair. I can't think that this was accidental. It was the way he liked to, let's say, possibly shield himself behind a persona.
Murray Melvin played the oily cleric Reverend Runt in Kubrick's exquisite and meticulously detailed period piece, Barry Lyndon. Murray recognized that it took quite a while to break through his director's outer shell.
I mean, I know it seems you're talking about this, you know, god of filmmaking, but Stanley was a shy person.
Technically minded from an early age, Kubrick became obsessed with gadgetry.
The latest, the newest, the best, the most, he loved it. He's an absolute gadget freak. He had hundreds of magazines, computers, cameras, you name it, everything.
Obsessive isn't too strong an adjective to describe Kubrick. Brian Aldiss recalls how he once caught him poring over the subtitles of one of his earliest films, The Killing.
This is perfectionism. You can either admire it or you can run from it screaming. It was his attention to detail that after all these years, he was never going to see it. Everything had to be just right. That was Stanley.
Is perfectionist a criticism or a praise? I've never quite sorted that one out.
Jan Harland was Kubrick's brother-in-law and executive producer on his later films.
Is it better to be a slob and make shortcuts and, you know, say, oh, well, 90% is good enough? Maybe if that's better, then, okay, then maybe that's a criticism. He thought 90% was a failure.
Kubrick had a very methodical mind. He was always planning. He was, perhaps not surprisingly, an avid chess player. As a young man, he used to hustle chess in the parks of New York. And chess also influenced the plots of his movies.
In Paths of Glory, the general's plan goes wrong. In 2001, HAL 9000, the perfect computer, goes badly wrong and starts to murder the people who should command him because HAL has been programmed with a flaw in him. The glitch in the perfect plan is one of the most constant elements in the plots of the films that Stanley Kubrick made.
With such an obsessive and methodical mind, it was almost inevitable that Kubrick came into conflict with some actors. Malcolm McDowell played the amoral and violent Alex in A Clockwork Orange, Kubrick's scathing satire on the not-so-distant future. He had a love-hate relationship with Kubrick and refused to play second fiddle to the hardware.
I don't even know whether he really liked actors. My theory is that basically he didn't, because he was a control freak. He was a control freak and an obsessive. So it's a strange thing, isn't it? You know, being a film director, which is, you depend on so many people.
He wanted to know everything. The costume, I mean, every detail. But then, surely that's a director's job. Because Stanley was on top of the job.
As a trained photographer, Kubrick was extremely knowledgeable about the technical aspects of filmmaking. And if he was hard on actors, he could be even harder on the crew.
He did give his technicians a very hard time. They had nervous breakdowns because Stanley would always question. Questioning, because Stanley wanted the right answer.
There's always two sides to it. Yes, you wouldn't get away with anything. Yes, he wouldn't allow shortcuts. But he also made sure that everybody delivered good quality. So there is the other side to it.
But with actors, he couldn't always get away with this approach.
Stanley knew that on the artistic side, with his actors, you can't do that. You can't pull out a number four just like that and get the right things. It has to come through a process. And so with his actors, Stanley's process was totally different.
The key work happened in his office, not even on the set. He typically was sitting with the actors before a scene in his office, alone. And they discussed the scene, and they rehearsed it sitting around a table.
I found very quickly that you had to come prepared with a character, with a performance, that he could use as the sort of bedrock to build the scenes.
Then they went onto the set and fairly soon started to have the first take.
He liked actors who could be both obedient to his direction and not worry or protest about the number of variations in the scene that they were asked to play.
Actors like Murray Melvin and Peter Sellers. Kubrick was particularly fond of Sellers and his ability to play multiple characters at the drop of a hat, most memorably in Dr. Strangelove.
I have a plan. Monsieur! Captain Ross!
To achieve these heights of comic brilliance, Kubrick felt he had to put his actors through endless takes.
You could do as many takes as you wanted with Stanley. He would only be too willing to do another take. If he thought that you thought there was a new idea, or if Stanley could see when you were actually working, when you were on camera, if he could see a spark of something different, and that's what Stanley was interested in, then he'd take and take and take, and he brought that spark out.
Stanley always believed in what James Joyce called accidents, that they weren't really accidents, that accidents were the portals to revelation. And that really explains why he would put some of his leading men and women through endless repetitions of the same scene, trying it different ways, until perhaps the star, without knowing it, would be giving a different interpretation that would be immensely more exciting or revealing of the character.
On the other hand, many of Kubrick's British actors complained that doing 100 takes was simply exhausting and boring. Maybe it had more to do with an obsessive nature than with artistic strategy. And if Kubrick planned for accidents in his filmmaking, he was quite different in his private life. Although he possessed a pilot's license, he refused to fly.
He figured that he knew enough about it to know that it was extremely dangerous. But, you know, we'd say, well, you know, Stanley, the facts are that it's, you know, much more dangerous crossing the high street than flying in a jumbo jet. But he wouldn't hear of it. He hated flying. That's why I think he stayed in England. Paranoia. He was very paranoid about things.
But, as Christian Kubrick explains, this fear was perhaps understandable.
A colleague of his, same age, same story, crashed his plane and was dead, and the crushed and burned camera and personal items were, for some reason, sent to Stanley. And without him knowing this, he obviously was traumatized, because when he went on a plane to Spain on Spartacus, he was sick on the plane. And on the way back, he was very ill indeed. All the phobic symptoms of heart beating and nausea and you name it. So he wasn't going to ever fly again. He didn't.
And Kubrick was no less cautious on Terra Firma. He was rumoured to drive no faster than 20 or 30 miles per hour.
Never get behind him leaving a location. There was a 12-mile traffic jam behind him. And you'd go, what is going on? Nowadays, you expect it. But in those days, you didn't expect that kind of traffic jam around Hertfordshire. And it was Stanley in his Mercedes.
It was a rumour that was started because when he was 30-something years old, he lifted the kitchen table and ruined his back. For 2 weeks in his life, he asked people to drive slowly because he really belonged in bed. That was the start of that rumour. Of course, he drove like anybody else.
Since Kubrick's death earlier this year, biographers and journalists have been busy purveying new stories about him. Partially, of course, as publicity for his last film, Eyes Wide Shut.
What I now read is sort of Stanley as Winnie the Pooh, which I really, really, we've dumbed him down. And that hurts. That was a mistake. You know, here we wanted to get rid of all the disaster stories, and instead of we cutesified him and cut him to size that way. And that is my great regret. Also, we did not express ourselves in these terms. Once they were sort of milled down to newspaperese, I was sick to read this, you know, Stan the teddy bear.
The teddy bear story is a shame. Because Kubrick, at his best, was that rare thing, a film director who was actually intelligent. 2001, for me, is particularly poignant because its most human character is the machine. In addition to its brilliant special effects, its philosophical statement is quite unique, that in order to become human, whether you're an ape or a computer, you have to become a murderer. Kubrick was one of a kind. What a pity that after collaborating for so many years with Brian Aldiss on artificial intelligence, he wasn't able to leave us that film as his legacy. Instead, he abandoned the project and directed a studio film, the somewhat predictable Eyes Wide Shut. The shadow of Hollywood had finally reached as far as Hertfordshire. And in the end, not even Kubrick could evade it.
In the Director's Chair was presented by Alex Cox and produced by Colin Hughes.